This is my attempt at hysterical edging from Bel Canto by Anne Patchett. This is really weird. I don't know how I'm going to do this. Okay, I am starting reading from page 117. How could there be a girl amongst them? How would they all fail to notice? The other girl was not so hard to figure out. Logic held that if there was one girl, then there could just as easily be more than one. And everyone looked immediately towards a silent boy who never answered questions and had seemed in every way unnatural from the start, much too beautiful, too nervous. His hairline dipped onto his forehead and made his face a perfect heart. His mouth was round and soft. His eyes stayed half closed, as if the heavy lashes seemed too great a burden to lift. He smelled different from the other boys. A sweet, warm smell, and his neck was long and smooth. He was the one who seemed so particularly in love with Roxanne Koss and slept on the hallway floor outside her room that night, using his body to prevent any drafts from coming in under the door. Jen looked at him, the one who had made him feel so uneasy, and the anxiousness he had held inside his chest rolled off him in a long, low wave. Beatrice, Simon Thibault said. That boy over there, is he your sister? Beatrice snorted and shook her head. Carmen, my sister? You must be crazy. At the sound of her name, Carmen looked up from across the room, Beatrice speaking her name. There was no such thing as a secret in this world. Carmen threw down the magazine she'd been looking at. It was Italian, with an abundance of glossy pictures of movie stars and royalty. The text undoubtedly contained important information about their most personal lives that she was unable to read. It had been found in the drawer of the nightstand beside the bed where the vice president's wife slept. Carmen took her revolver into the kitchen and shut the door, and no one followed her. A visibly angry teenager girl with a gun. There was nowhere to go, and everyone assumed that eventually she would come out on her own. They wanted to look at her again, to see her without a cap on, to have the time to contemplate her as a girl, but they were willing to wait. If this was the drama of the afternoon, one of the terrorists taking herself hostage for a few hours, then the suspense was better than single-mindedly watching the drizzle. I should have known she was a girl, Reuben said to Oscar Mendoza, the contractor, who lived only a few miles away. Oscar shrugged. I have 5 daughters at home. I never saw a girl in this room. He stopped to reconsider this point and then leaned in towards the vice president. I just saw one girl in this room, you know, one woman. There can only be one woman in this room. He tilted his head meaningfully towards the far side of the room where Roxanne Koss sat. Reuben nodded. Of course, he said. Of course. I am thinking there will never be a better opportunity than this to tell her that I love her. Oscar rubbed his hand over his chin. I don't necessarily mean right now. It doesn't have to be today, although it could be today. These days are so long that by supper the time could be exactly right. You never know until it comes to you, you know, until you are in exactly in that place. He was a big man, well over 6 feet and broad through the shoulders. He had stayed strong because even though he was a contractor, he was not above pitching in and carrying boards or putting up sheetrock. In this way, he remained a fine example to the men who worked for him. Oscar Mendoza had to bend forward so as to speak softly in the vice president's ear. But I will do it while we are here. You mark my words. Reuben nodded. Ooh. Roxanne Koss had given up her evening gown days ago and was now wearing a pair of tan slacks, that belonged to his wife, as well as his wife's favourite cardigan, a navy sweater of extremely fine baby alpaca he had bought for her on their second anniversary. He had requested a guard accompany him upstairs. He went to the closet himself and brought the sweater down to the soprano. Put it on the low pattern. He had requested a guard accompany him upstairs. He went to the closet himself and brought the sweater down to the soprano. "Are you cold?" he had asked, and then draped the cardigan gently around her shoulders. Was it a betrayal, so quickly giving up the sweater his wife loved? The clothing conflated the two women for him in a way that was extraordinarily pleasing. His beautiful guest wearing the clothes of his wife, whom he so dearly missed, the traces of his wife's perfume still lingering inside the ribbing of the sweater, so that he could smell both women there when he passed the one. If this wasn't enough to ask, Roxanne was wearing a pair of familiar slippers that belonged to the governess, Esmeralda, because his wife's shoes had been too small. How delightful it had been to put his head inside Esmeralda's tiny, meticulous closet. "Are you going to tell her you love her?" the contractor asked. "It is your home. I would certainly defer to your right to go first." Reuben considered his guest's thoughtful invitation. "It is a possibility." He was trying not to stare at Roxanne. He was failing. He imagined taking her hand, suggesting he could show her the stars from the wide stone veranda that wrapped around the back of the house. That is, he would have if they had been allowed to go outside. He was the vice president after all, and that might impress her. At least she was not a tall woman. She was a pixie, a pocket Venus. He was grateful for that. "It might not be appropriate, given my position here." "What's appropriate?" Oscar said. His voice was light and unconcerned. "They're bound to kill us in the end. Either the ones inside or the ones outside. The shooting will start. There will be some terrible mistake. You can bank on it. The ones outside can't let it look like we were not mistreated. It will be important to them that we wind up dead. Think of the people. The masses. You can't have them getting the wrong idea. You're the government man. You know more about these things than I do. It does happen." "Then what's the point of not telling her? I, for one, want to know that in my last days I made some effort. I'm going to speak to the young Japanese man, the translator. When the time is right, when I know what I want to say. You can't approach a woman like that. Too quickly." Reuben liked the contractor. Although they'd never met before, the very fact that they both lived in the same city made them feel like neighbours, and then old friends, and then brothers. "What do you know about women like that?" Oscar chuckled and put his hand down on his brother's shoulder. "Little Vice President," he said, "there are so many things that I know." It was big talk, but in this place big talk seemed appropriate. While he had lost every freedom he was most accustomed to, a new, smaller set of freedoms began to raise a dim light within him. The liberty to think obsessively and the right to remember detail. Away from his wife and five daughters, he was not contradicted or corrected. And without these burdens, he found himself able to dream without constant revision. He had lived his life as a good father, but now Oscar Mendoza saw again his life as a boy. He lived his life as a good father, but now Oscar Mendoza saw again his life as a boy. A daughter was always a battle between fathers and boys, in which the fathers fought valiantly and always lost. He knew that one by one, each of his daughters would be lost. Either honorably in the ceremony of marriage, or realistically in a car pointed out towards the ocean well after dark. In his day, Oscar himself... In his day, Oscar himself had made too many girls forget their better instincts and find training. By biting them with tender persistence at the base of their skull, just where their hairline grew in downy wisps. Girls were like kittens in this way. If he got them right at the nape of their neck, they went easily limp. Then he would whisper his suggestions, all the things they might do together, the wonderful dark explorations for which he was to be their guide. His voice travelled like a drug, dripped down the spiraling canals of their ears until they had forgotten everything, until they had forgotten their own names, until they turned and offered themselves up to him, their bodies sweet and soft as marzipan. Oscar shuddered at the thought. As he was ready to play the part of the boy again, he could see the lines of boys forming around his house. Boys ready to assuage the awful grief of his daughters, now that their father was held hostage. Pilar, how awful this must be for you. Isabel, you mustn't stay shut away. Teresa, your father wouldn't want such suffering. Look at this, I bought you some flowers, or a bird, a skein of yarn, a coloured pencil. It made no difference. Would his wife have the sense to lock the door? She would never have sense enough to believe that the boys meant them any harm. She believed their lies now, just as she had believed him then, when she was a girl and he had come to call while her father lay dying from cancer. What was he thinking of chasing after an opera singer? Who were these two girls anyway, Beatrice and Carmen? What were they doing here? Where were their fathers? Probably gunned down in some countryside revolution. Oh. What could such girls do to keep the boys away without fathers to protect them? Everywhere in this house there were boys, those awful surly boys with their greasy hair and bitten fingernails hoping to touch a breast. You look bad, the vice president said. All this talk of love isn't agreeing with you. I've got to stop. You look bad, the vice president said. All this talk of love isn't agreeing with you. When will we get out of here? Oscar said. He sat down on the sofa and dropped his head onto his knees as if dizzy. Get out of here? You're the one who said we'd be shot. I've changed my mind. No one is going to kill me. I may kill someone, but no one is going to kill me. Reuben sat down beside him and leaned his good cheek against his friend's broad shoulder. Do you play the piano? Roxanne Koss said to Jen.
He hadn't seen her coming. His back was to the room while he watched the Karua from the bay window. He was learning to relax as he watched it, not to strain his eyes. He was beginning to think he could see things. Mr. Hosokawa looked at Jen expectantly, clearly anxious to know what she was saying. And for a minute, Jen was confused as to whether he should answer her or translate first, as the question was directed. Mr. Hosokawa looked at Jen expectantly, clearly anxious to know what she was saying, and for a minute Jen was confused as to whether he should answer her or translate first, as the question was directed to him. He translated, and then he told her no. He was sorry to say that he did not. "I thought you might," she said. "You seem to know how to do so many things." She looked towards his companion. "What about Mr. Hosokawa?" Fuck. Mr. Hosokawa shook his head sadly. "Until their capture." He had thought of his life in terms of achievement and success. Now it struck him as a long list of failures. He didn't speak English or Italian or Spanish. He didn't play the piano. He had never even tried to play the piano. He and Jen didn't have a single lesson between them. Rob's... Oh, I gotta stop. And now it struck him as a long list of failures. He didn't speak English or Italian or Spanish. He didn't play the piano. He had never even tried to play the piano. He and Jen didn't have a single lesson between them. Roxanne Koss looked across the room as if she were looking for her accompanist. But he was already half a world away now, his grave now covered by an early Swedish frost. "I keep telling myself that this is going to be over soon, and that I'm just taking a vacation from work." She looked up at Jen. "Not that I think this is a vacation, of course. We've been in this miserable place nearly 2 weeks. I've never gone a week without singing, unless I was sick. I'm going to have to start practicing soon." She leaned in towards the two of them, and they bent towards her reflexively. "I really don't want to sing here. I don't want to give them the satisfaction. Do you think it would be worth it to wait another couple of days? Do you think they'll let us go by then?" She glanced across the room again to see if there was a particularly elegant pair of hands. Elegant pair of hands folded across a lap. "Surely someone here must play," Jen said, not wanting to address the other issue. "The piano is very good. I can play a little, but not to accompany myself." I somehow doubt they'd go out and kidnap a new accompanist for me. Oh, then she spoke directly to Mr. Hosokawa. I don't know what to do with myself when I'm not singing. I don't have any talent for vacation. I feel very much the same way, he said to himself, his voice growing fainter with each word, when I'm not able to listen to opera. For this, Roxanne smiled. Such a dignified man. Oh. In the others, she could see a look of fear, the occasional brush of panic. Not that there was anything wrong with the panic given the circumstances. She had cried herself to sleep most nights. She cried herself to sleep most nights. But it never seemed to touch Mr. Hosokawa, or he managed not to show it. And then, when she stood near him, she somehow did not feel the panic herself, although she couldn't explain it. Near him, it felt like she was stepping out of a harsh light and into some place quiet and dark. Like she was wrapping herself up in the heavy velvet of the stage curtains where no one could see her. You should help me find an accompanist, she told him, and then both our problems will be solved. Fuck. All of her makeup was gone now. For the first few days, she bothered to go to the lavatory and put on lipstick from the tube she carried in her evening bag. Then her hair went back in a tight elastic, and she was wearing someone else's clothes that did not exactly fit. Mr. Hosokawa thought that every day she was lovelier. He had wanted so many times to ask her to sing, but he never would have, since singing for him was the thing that had brought her all the trouble in the first place. He wasn't able to ask her for a hand of cards or for her thoughts on the Garua. He did not seek her out at all, and so Jen did not either. In fact, both of them had noticed that, with the exception of the priest, whom she could not understand, all the men, in their desire to speak to her, had decided to leave her alone as if it were some sort of respect. So alone she sat, hour after hour. Sometimes she cried. Another time she thumbed through books or took naps on the sofa. It was a pleasure to watch her sleep. Roxanne was the only hostage to have the privilege of a bedroom and her own guard who slept outside her door. So whether that was to keep her in or to keep other people out was not entirely sure. Now that they knew the guard was calm, and they wondered if she was only trying to keep herself safe by staying near such an important person. Perhaps the vice president plays, Mr. Hosokawa suggested. He has a fine piano. Jen went off to find the vice president, who was asleep in a chair. Oh, fuck. Jen asked, beginning with the Russians who were smoking in the dining room. They squinted at him through the blue haze and then shook their heads. My God, said Viktor Fyodorov, covering his heart with his hand. What I would not give to know. Tell the Red Cross to send in a teacher and I will learn for her. The other two Russians laughed and threw down their cards. Piano? Jen asked the next group. He made his way through the house, asking all of the guests. Skipping over their captors. On the assumption that piano lessons... Were impossibility and impossibility in the jungle. Jen imagined lizards on the petals. Humidity warping the keyboard, persistent vines winding their way up the heavy wooden legs. Oh fuck. One Spaniard, Manuel Flores, one Frenchman, Etienne Boyer, and one Argentinian, Alejandro Rivas, said they could play a little, but didn't read music. Andreas. Epicetus said he had played quite well in his youth, but hadn't touched a piano in years. Every day my mother made me practice, he said. The day I moved away from home, I piled up all the music in the back of my house and I lit it right there with her watching. Fuck. The day I moved away from home, I piled up all the music in the back of the house and I lit it right there with her watching. I haven't laid a finger to a piano since. The rest of them said no. They didn't play. People began recounting stories of a couple of lessons or the lessons of their childhood. Voices fell over one another, and from every corner of the room there came the word piano, piano, piano. It seemed to Jen, and he included himself in this assessment, that never had a more uncultured group of men been taken hostage. What have they been doing all these years that no one had bothered with such an important instrument? They all wish they could play, if not then, if not before, then certainly now, to be able to play for Roxanne. Tetsuya Kato, a vice president at Mansei, whom Jen had known for years, smiled and walked to the Steinway without a word. A slightly built man in his early 50s, with graying hair, who in Jen's memory rarely spoke. The sleeves to his tuxedo jacket were rolled up above his elbows, and his jacket was long gone, but he sat down on the bench with great formality. The ones in the living room watched him as he lifted the cover of the keyboard and ran his hands once slightly over the keyboards, over the keys, soothing them. Oh, fuck. Some of the others were still talking about the piano. You could hear the Russians' voices coming from the dining room. Then, without making a request for anyone's attention, Tetsuya Kato began to play. He started with Chopin's Nocturne Opus 9, E flat major number 2. It was the piece he had most often heard in his head since coming to this country. The one he played silently against the edge of the dining room table when no one was watching. At home, he looked at his sheet music and turned the pages. Now, he was certain he had known the music all along. He could see the notes in front of him, and he followed them unerring fidelity in his heart. Oh, God, I need to come. In his heart, he had never felt closer to Chopin. Ah, whom he loved like a father. How strange. His fingers felt after 2 weeks of not playing, as if the skin he wore now was entirely new. He could hear the softest click of his fingernail 2 weeks long as he touched the keys. Oh, the felt-covered hammers tapped the strings gently at first and the music. Oh, fuck. And the music, even for those who had never heard the piece before, was like a memory from all over the house, terrorist and hostage. The light turned and listened and felt a great easing in their chests. There was a delicacy about Tetsuya Kato's hands, as if they were simply resting in one place on the keyboard and then in another. And suddenly his right hand spun out notes like water, sounds so light and high, that there was a temptation to look beneath. Ah, oh, fuck the lid for bells. Ah, oh, fuck. Kato closed his eyes so that he could imagine he was home, playing his own piano. His wife was asleep. His children, two unmarried sons still living at home with them, were asleep. From the notes of Kato's playing, for them, the notes of Kato's playing had become like air, what they depended on, and had long stopped noticing. And he put that into the nocturne, his son's steady breathing, his wife clenching her pillow with one hand, and all of the tenderness he felt for them went into the keys. He touched them as if he meant not to wake them. Oh, fuck. It was the love and loneliness. Oh, fuck that each of them. Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck that each of them fell. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And that no one had bought himself to speak of. Had the accompanist. Oh. had the accompanist played so well, it would have been impossible to remember his talent was to be invisible, to lift the soprano up. But now... oh, fuck. But now the people in the living room of the vice presidential mansion listened to Cato with hunger, and nothing in their lives had ever fed them so well. Oh, fuck. Most of the men there did not know him, and most of them had no distinct memory of having noticed him up to this point. So that in a way they felt he had come in from the outside world to play for them. Oh, none of the men who did know him knew that he played. That he continued his lessons and practiced for an hour every morning. Before boarding the train for work, it had been important to Cato to have another life, a secret life. Now the secrecy of it did not fuck! They were all at the piano. Roxanne Koss and Mr. Hosokawa and Jen and Simon Thibault and the priest. Oh, fuck. And the vice president and Oscar Mendoza. And little Ishmael and Beatrice and Carmen, who left a gun in the kitchen and came and stood with the rest. All of the Russians were there, and the Germans, who had spoken of a revolt. Oh, fuck. And the Italians, who were weeping, and the two Greeks, who were older than the rest of us. Oh, the boys were there, Paco and Renato and Umberto and Bernardo and all the rest. Oh, the great a menacing hulk of boy flesh that seemed to soften with every note. Even the generals came. Oh, every last one of them came until there were 58 people in the room. And when he finished, Tetsuya Kato bowed his head while they applauded. Oh, had there not been a need for a pianist, there was little chance that Kato would have sat down that afternoon to play, although he had watched the piano the way other men watched the door. Oh, he would not have chosen to draw attention to himself. And without his playing, the story might have missed him altogether. Oh, fuck, but there was a need, a specific request, and so he stepped forward. Fine, fine, General Benjamin said, feeling good to think. Ah, the accompaniments, accompanists that had been lost was now replaced. Oh, very well done. Mr. Osaka was said, so proud that it was an insane man stepping up for the job. That was me reading from Bel Canto by Anne Pratchett.